Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really happy to be speaking again with Dr. Peter Dale Scott today. And Peter Dale Scott is a former professor of English at the University of California in Berkeley, among other places, and also formerly was a Canadian diplomat because he's from Canada, and he's also written some very interesting books and is a student slash activists around political issues. One of his books that always sticks in my mind is Cocaine Politics, Drugs, Armies, and the CIA in Central America. And he wrote that with Jonathan Marshall. He also was the author of Deep Politics and the Death of JFK and is a poet, with his most recent book being Minding the Darkness, which is a poem, I guess, about the issues that we're going to be speaking about, although we're not going to be speaking about his poem. But if you are into poetry, you should check out Minding the Darkness. We're going to be talking about oil, drugs, and what that has to do with the mix of things that's been happening, starting with 9/11, with the planes flying into the World Trade Center in New York. So, welcome, Peter Dale Scott.
Hi.
Well, you can just dive in wherever you want and explaining what oil and drugs have to do with what's going on now, which is really major in the world. I mean, we're as far as I'm concerned, in a really major crisis in many, many ways. And certainly 9/11 has brought things even more to a head than they were already. I like to say we had enough problems before then just with the environment and in issues of basically survival on the planet. But we're not going to get into all that. But we are going to get into oil and drugs, which does seem to be much more, have to do with much more going on than the average person thinks. So tell us.
Well, I'd like to talk about drugs and oil. Let's just start with Afghanistan, keep it focused. Mm-hmm. These are two aspects of what I call the deep politics of the situation, the issues that are not normally discussed candidly in at least the U.S. press, although there's been much better reporting in some other countries. To take drugs first, it's not generally known in the United States, and people are really quite astonished when I tell them a number of things. First of all, that starting really with the first U.S. intervention in Afghanistan back in 1979, drug production, opium cultivation in the Afghanistan area has soared. It went from, a couple of hundred tons back in the 70s up to, in 1999, it was 3,600 and some tons, which was more than half of the global production of 7,000 tons. I find a lot of Americans didn't know that.
This is heroin we're talking about?
Well, most of it, yes, is processed into heroin. And when we first gave aid to Mujahideen in Afghanistan, this was actually just before the Soviets invaded, and Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, has since boasted. He said that we gave that aid in order to force the Soviets to intervene in Afghanistan because we knew it would be terrible for them. He's very proud of that, the fact that he really created this Soviet invasion, because it led ultimately, was certainly a significant factor in the breakup of the Soviet Union. It also caused more than 1 million deaths in Afghanistan, which he seems to think was worth it to achieve his geostrategical goal, as he calls it. But anyway, from the very beginning, we were giving aid to, you call them what you like, warlords, mujahideen, but people who were up to then financing their activities and to some extent continued to finance their activities by the cultivation of opium and even the processing of it into heroin. There were heroin plants up on the Pakistani-Afghan border before the United States ever went in 79, but in a small way. And since then, of course, it's become huge. Now, the second thing that a lot of people don't know is that when the Taliban came in 94, 95, 96, they initially, like the people before them, taxed the cultivation of opium. They would just take a straight 10% of the value in the field, which is actually pretty low compared to the ultimate price of heroin in the United States. And bin Laden also, apparently, was taxing and maybe even more involved in the actual trafficking of drugs than the Taliban were. And according to a number of European sources, the drug trade, as opposed to just cultivation, was a significant source of bin Laden's income. Surprisingly, that was not very reported in the United States. The United States could have said, we were going to, you know, we fight a war on drugs in Colombia, we go into Colombia. Why not fight a war on drugs and go after bin Laden? And I think the answer to that is a third thing, which most Americans didn't realize, is the Taliban, you know, wanted very much to be recognized by as the government of Afghanistan. And in fact, only three countries recognize it: Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. And it's, I think, pretty clear now that America considered recognizing the Taliban. In fact, actually had reasons that some Americans wanted very much to recognize the Taliban because they thought the Taliban was the best hope for uniting the whole of Afghanistan.
I have the impression that the United States supported the Taliban, gave money, helped them.
Well, they gave $43 million in the year 2001, actually, the spring of last year. But that was for a specific thing. That was because the Taliban, it had to do two things to get recognition, and it did do one of them, which was stamp out the cultivation of opium. That was an American requirement for recognition, and the Taliban met it astonishingly well. Starting in 1999, they limited production. They limited it by about 30%. But in the year, the planting in 2000, which was the crop that would have come up in 2001, essentially it did not come up. That is to say, they had almost total eradication of opium in the part of Afghanistan under their control. So that the UN brought out a report in October of last year, just 3 months ago, in which they said that the Taliban ban on opium cultivation was almost 100% effective, that instead of producing an estimated 3,600 tons, as they did in the year 2000, it dropped to only 185 tons. And this is for the whole of Afghanistan. That's a 94% reduction. I mean, it's an astonishing reduction. And the only place where the cultivation of opium not only continued but actually increased, it roughly trebled, was the part of Afghanistan being controlled by the Northern Alliance, who were to be our allies. So that what was happening was, this is why we weren't talking about a war on drugs, because we were going in support of the people who were cultivating the opium in order to fight the Taliban who had just stamped it out. A lot of Americans find this hard to believe. And there's even more about, we may come back to this, but I just want to follow through on the story. In I think it was September 17th, which was 6 days after 9/11, it was already obvious that the United States had said they were going to retaliate against the Taliban if they didn't hand over bin Laden. That was the second thing that they were supposed to do, and they never did do it. There were elements in the Taliban, I think, who would have been very happy to see bin Laden leave the country, and they were discussing a formula whereby he might go to another Muslim country and be tried there, such as Saudi Arabia. And I think there's been pretty continuous negotiation over this, first under Clinton, and then secondly under Bush. But they could never, the Taliban is right, a fairly loosely coordinated group of people, and the people in Kabul who looked like the government were open to this, but in the end everything had to be fed back to Mullah Omar, who was in Kandahar, and he was much closer than most of the Taliban to bin Laden and never agreed to his being dismissed. As I said a while back, there were some Americans who very much wanted an agreement to recognize the Taliban, and the most prominent of these was the oil company, it used to be called Union Oil of California, now we call it Unocal. And they were already involved with the government of Turkmenistan in oil and gas production there. And they very much wanted a pipeline that would bring, one to bring gas and one to bring oil out of Turkmenistan down into Pakistan. And when Benazir Bhutto was still the prime minister of Pakistan, she thought, too, this would solve a lot of Pakistan's problems. It would beef up their economy, give them oil supplies that they needed, and be a sort of precedent for Pakistan being a gateway to Central Asia, which is going to be a huge new market as the oil and gas of this very petroleum-rich region is developed. So that...
Excuse me, are you gonna, a market? You mean to sell oil to?
No. Well, they'll be buying the oil and gas and selling all kinds of things in exchange because you expect the standard of living is going to go way up in this part of the world. Everybody who's interested in oil is interested in Central Asia, not so much Afghanistan, although it too has gas in the northwest corner, but it Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, there are huge oil reserves and gas reserves there, as also further west in Azerbaijan. This is the huge new area for oil and gas development. And particularly China is going to be an oil-hungry country fairly soon as it continues to increase at, 7% a year or something like that. Obviously, their oil consumption is going to go up beyond what I think they can get domestically. And America always has two interests in oil. It needs oil for itself. We are just about, the largest oil. We have domestic production, but we and Japan both import enormous amounts of oil, and that's why the United States, starting with Carter, has said that we have a national security interest in the Persian Gulf, and that's why we fought the Iraq War, for example, the Gulf War of 1990, partly to secure access to the oil, but we have a second interest in oil, which most people are not aware of, which is that in the aftermath of the oil crises of the 1970s, America rescued itself from what could have been impoverishment when the oil price quadrupled very suddenly. and huge amounts of what we call petrodollars started flowing to Saudi Arabia, everything would have been totally out of balance in this country, and we were already having balance of payments problems, running deficits, because we import so much more of everything than we export. We do not produce and export in a way which by itself would justify the very affluent lifestyle that Americans are used to living in. And the device that was worked out to save the U.S. dollar was, there were two things. First of all, a secret deal, was made with Saudi Arabia that it would invest its petrodollars back in the United States so that the U.S. economy would still be affluent enough to be able to buy Saudi oil. The second agreement, which affects the whole world and very negatively affects some parts of the world, was when Saudi Arabia was admitted to the International Monetary Fund. This is another secret agreement. The United States agreed secretly with Saudi Arabia to let it into the IMF, and in exchange, Saudi Arabia would use its power in OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, to be sure that all sales of OPEC oil to anybody, Japan, for example, would be paid for in dollars. Well, what that means, and extremely important for the United States, is that if Japan wants to buy oil from Indonesia, it has to buy American dollars in order to pay for the oil. So that we still have a market for our dollars overseas, even though we are not producing and exporting terribly much for people. It's not our goods they're buying, it's OPEC oil that they're buying, but this is what keeps the U.S. currency a solid currency. If it was just, you know, what I was taught about economics when I was in college was that if you import a great deal and you export very little, you're going to experience inflation. Mm-hmm. And for a while we did experience, back in the late 70s, tremendous inflation, which was stopped by this secret deal. And I want to say how this is good for America, but it's really coming out of the hide of the third world, because it's forcing these third world countries to buy dollars for their oil. And we've had a major problem in the world of the indebtedness of third world countries ever since, not just the poorest ones, but even relatively important oil-producing countries like Mexico have had a series of crises because of their difficulty in meeting their debt payments.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind people that my guest is Dr. Peter Dale Scott, who has written about, studied these matters of oil and drugs for many years, and was formerly a professor at the University of California in Berkeley, and other places also, and also formerly a Canadian diplomat. So we're going to continue on here. It's really very useful to talk to you, as I knew it would be, Peter. And I'm learning a lot. And of course, everything is all connected, and we could go on forever about all these things.
I'd like to bring it back to Central Asia, if I could.
Okay.
All this long talk about the America needs oil. It doesn't particularly need the oil of Central Asia or the gas of Central Asia. It would be expensive to bring that to the United States. But it needs to control that market. It wants to go on being a dominant force in the world oil scene so that to as greatest extent possible it can ensure that OPEC oil, as much oil as possible, is paid for in dollars, even if it's oil going from Turkmenistan to China. Mm-hmm. And Russia is also competing in the opposite direction. There is a certain amount of tension between Russia and America here about the future of Afghanistan, because quite clearly in 1996, not only UNICAL, but the State Department – were hoping that if you could punch some pipelines through Afghanistan from Central Asia, specifically Turkmenistan, out to Pakistan, then that Central Asian oil and gas would begin to flow into the OPEC market. It would be shipped in tankers out of the Persian Gulf, the way OPEC oil is. Russia, conversely, wants very much, up to now, it's had the privilege that the only pipelines going into Central Asia flowed north into Russia. Russia wants to keep it that way. Those people who were talking about geostrategy in Afghanistan see a contest between the Americans who want the oil to flow south, and if they're going to be drugs, want the drugs to flow north. And the Russians, conversely, see it just the other way around. They want the oil and gas to flow north, and if there have to be drugs, they want the drugs to flow south, because the drugs have been a terrible scourge in Russia ever since they invaded Afghanistan. It seems quite clear that one of the reasons that the CIA was so tolerant to the Mujahideen they were supporting getting into the growing of opium and the processing of heroin is because it was being given to Soviet soldiers who took the habit back to Russia. And apparently we even had shipments of cocaine coming all the way from Colombia to Afghanistan. The Afghans never developed a coke habit, but a lot of Russian soldiers did, and cocaine is now huge in the former Soviet Union. And of course, this all has to do with the increase in power of the Russian mafia, who were definitely another factor in the breakup of the Soviet Union, and who very clearly now collaborate on the global level with the Sicilian mafia and the Colombian cartels. We have one of the byproducts of the first American intervention in 1979 is a kind of global mafia. There is actually a book by that title, and they talk about these meetings where the Sicilians and the Colombians and the Russians all get together. And what a lot of people don't know about the Russian mafia is that some of its top leadership is in Brighton Beach in Long Island in New York City. And there are a lot of things that have not yet been explained about the CIA and drugs, not just in Latin America, where I've written a book about it, but in Afghanistan and the spread of drugs into Russia, which really began visibly after our intervention in 1979. Some people predicted that the Taliban, having outlawed production, really did it to keep the price up, that they knew there were stocks of opium that would last a year or more. And so they predicted that if we invaded or bombed, they would dump all that opium. That, I think, was wrong. The Taliban taxes the trade, but they don't run the trade. Bin Laden is something else, but the Taliban, they take their 10% when it's grown, and that's the end of it for them. There was not a lot of dumping in the short run, but what is clear is that as the Taliban was driven out of all these provinces of Afghanistan, everywhere they were driven out, the farmers who had already planted their wheat just took the plow out again and plowed the wheat over and put in opium poppy. They're predicting a crop of about 2,800 tons of opium for 2002, not as much as the 3,600 back in 1999, but enough to correct what would otherwise have been virtually a closing down of more than half of the world heroin industry, something which was prevented from happening, and not for the first time, by a U.S. invasion. One of the things that I've done research into is the role of in all, four U.S. interventions in Asia, going back to 1949-50, which have, in effect, saved the world heroin business at a time when it was threatened. Not that I think that the top leadership of the United States wanted to save it, but you see, the, time after time, we ally ourselves with what I call drug proxies, like the Kuomintang of Chiang Kai-shek, for example, who were our proxies in Burma and then later in Laos. It's not our motive that we should strengthen the world heroin industry, but it is the motive of the drug proxies. And some of the people that we allied ourselves with in Afghanistan, first in 1979 and again just in the last few months, of people who, even before they're anti-communists or they're Islamists or any of these things, they are drug traffickers. And it is very much their intention to use a U.S. presence in order to strengthen their position in the drug trade. This is, I'm afraid, a recurring pattern. As I say, my whole analysis of what happened in Indochina with the Americans, it was a Vietnam War, but it began in Laos, and I now believe, partly from what we've seen in Afghanistan, that we were suckered into going into Laos by people like the KMT and other drug traffickers, because the drug traffic itself was under attack, and that was a bigger factor than what we were told at the time, which was communist moves to go in. There were no such communist moves. That was an invention. There was a very real threat to the drug trade, and it was solved by having Air America fly to the drug-producing areas. So this is what, as I say, the deep politics of drugs and oil is that we use drug proxies over and over, and we do it in areas which are important to us because of the presence of oil nearby.
Just define that word, drug proxy, or two words.
Oh, when that we're not going to send our own armies to do all the work. We're going to have someone do it for us. And we can't even pay all the expenses of that army. So we have an army which is financing itself by drugs on the side. As when I say Mujahideen, those were our allies or proxies. They were really, not from their point of view, but from our point of view, they were fighting for us, and we didn't have to foot the bill because some of it was paid for by us, some of it by Saudi Arabia, but a good deal of it was paid for by drugs.
Well, you can get to know more about all this, where our time is about up here, but you can check out Peter Dale Scott's book, Cocaine, Politics, Drugs, Armies in the CIA and Central America, to get a bit of an idea about this. That book was a while ago and about a different part of the world, but it'll give you the general gist, and also you can look at his webpage for up-to-date information about what's what you think is important, Peter Dale Scott, for people to know about oil, drugs, and Afghanistan and other things. So let's give your webpage.
If you search for Peter Dale Scott altogether inside quotation marks, almost the first thing you'll see is Peter Dale Scott, poetical and political writings, and halfway down the home page under my picture, it clicks on for 9/11 and Afghanistan.
Peter Dale, D-A-L-E, Scott, S-C-O-T-T. So that's pretty easy. Thank you very much, Peter Dale Scott, and my name's Sue Supriano. And thank you all for listening.